It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios Maria Tomchik with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this week.
No job this week. He's traveling.
He's traveling. We got tons to cover, so let's just dive right in, starting with local, as we always do. And Mayor Greg Nickels.
Yes, looking for ways to plug holes in the city budget. He went to the fund that funds the community centers. There are some 38 community centers in the city of Seattle, like, for example, the Finney Neighborhood Center or the University Heights School, you know, that provide rooms that, you know, local community centers and groups can rent and provide other services. He went to that fund and he took about a third of the money and he put it back into the city budget. The only problem with that is that most of the money in that fund is money that people have donated to the city centers or have paid in the form of room rent or class fees or money that was raised by the community centers themselves for through fundraising activities and so forth. And you could say that he stole that money that people donated to the city centers or paid in classroom fees. As a person who uses a community center twice a week and has for the last 15 years, I feel pretty alarmed by this. I'm always assuming that the money I pay to help rent a room there is going to fund the community centers and to provide upkeep for the centers, some of which are in terrible disrepair. And some of which some of the organizations that run community centers don't even own the buildings that are used for that purpose. Many of them rent the buildings from the Seattle School District. And there are some groups, I'm sure, that would like to be able to purchase the buildings and or do maintenance or upgrade the buildings to provide better services to the community. But when the city's busy stealing money from the fund that provides funding for those kinds of things, it makes it awfully hard to do that. So I found that pretty alarming. And I would just have to tell folks that if you find that alarming, too, you ought to contact the mayor's office and tell them what you think. Also, I found it pretty alarming that City Councilman Tom Rasmussen thought it was a good idea for the city to raid those funds, saying that, well, if the funds are just sitting there, they ought to be used, you know. To me, that's just no. That's just terrible. So I think you ought to contact Rasmussen as well.
Yeah, maybe they could just go to some of those large corporate banks that just have money that they've been swapping back and forth.
That they've just been sitting on.
We gave to them. All right, moving on. The snow saga continues.
Oh yeah, the snow saga continues with the report this week that sand is clogging up the West Point wastewater sewage treatment plant. That on April 16th, the plant had to shut down a pump in one of their basins because it was completely clogged with sand that has been washed off the streets after the snowstorm. And it's interesting because the City Department of Transportation says that they've swept up some 11,300 tons of sand from the streets, and they say that's a little bit more than 90% of what was spread in December during the snowstorms. But since the city was not exactly forthcoming, the Seattle Department of Transportation wasn't exactly forthcoming about their response to the snowstorm, makes you wonder if they're really telling the truth this time as well. The city council on Wednesday released their report on the December snowstorms, and their conclusions were that the city of Seattle didn't have an emergency response team in place, even though an executive order had required the city to set one up, to set up a team that would handle citywide emergencies. Sort of begs the question of what would we do if we had a major earthquake or some other kind of emergency. The city didn't have a team set up to deal with emergencies in the first place. During the storms, Seattle Department of Transportation didn't keep a permanent record of snow plowing schedules. That's another conclusion of the report, that the city used a dry erase board and handwritten notes in order to keep track of where the plows were going. It's kind of makes me think about times in the office where I work when you forget to do something and someone says, well, didn't you see my Post-it note? It was on the Post-it note. You know, if that's the way the Department of Transportation was running the snow response, then no wonder it was so terrible. Seattle Department of Transportation apparently let the snowplow drivers and the road crew teams decide where they were going to plow. There was no central coordination, apparently. And they did the same thing with the sands, with the sand dumping. Nobody was quite sure where the sand was being spread or when. And so, obviously, much of it was going to end up in the sewage treatment system because, you know, how are you going to send out, trucks to pick things, to pick up the sand if you don't exactly know where you spread it in the first place? And apparently the folks in charge of the Seattle Department of Transportation also didn't know that they could use the Emergency Operations Center, even though it was available and is essentially was built for that kind of a situation. It's an Emergency Operations Center. When you have an emergency, you should use it. Well, the Seattle Department of Transportation folks didn't know that. And it would have helped, of course, to have an emergency response team in place to tell them, look, use the Emergency Operations Center. And because there was no emergency response team in place, the only person, the person who was in charge of the snow response was the street maintenance director, who had no training and no experience handling a major snowstorm. So this really, when you look at it, it's a total failure on the part of the mayor, who should have made sure that we had an emergency response team trained and in place. And it also begs the question, do we even have one now? And is anybody following up on this? I would like to hear from Mayor Nichols. Do we have an emergency response team trained and in place to deal with something like if, for example, the viaduct were to collapse, or if we have an earthquake, if we have a major heat wave that sends a lot of people to the hospital? What if we have a tsunami? What if we have a pandemic, you know, all that kind of stuff? We need to know that, and he needs to tell us that, whether or not we have that. And if we don't have that in place, he needs to do it now.
All right, moving on. This last Sunday was the final day for the legislature.
Yeah, the state legislature in its final hours passed a bill that allows the State Department of Transportation to impose tolls on the 520 bridge in order to pay for a replacement span. It also, the law said that the state DOT can decide when and how much of tolls to put in place, and the state DOT is directed to set up a study group to develop a financing plan for the 520 bridge. The legislation also set the cost of the project at $4.65 billion, which I have to tell you is on the low end. I've seen estimates that go much, much higher than that. And I think also we're going to probably see cost overruns when and if the 520 bridge replacement does get underway.
Well, that takes us then to national and the starting with the House Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, yes. This week the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers, and 15 other members, all Democrats, of the committee sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder. Basically, they were responding to the revelations in the past week or two about the torture memos. The Bush administration's so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, really the torture of detainees in the war on terrorism. The letter asked the Attorney General to appoint a special counsel to investigate and prosecute those individuals involved in drafting the torture memos and in implementing the torture of detainees. And I found it interesting, too, that you saw a lot more pundits this week come forward and say, yes, it is the Attorney General's responsibility to get a special investigation going, or of Congress to set up a special commission. Something has to be done in order to address this. We can't just let it go, say the past is the past, and sweep it under the rug. We really need to know not just who was involved and why, but we need to know how it happened and how we set up a culture for this thing to, you know, how the hysteria led to this sort of thing, the culture of secrecy at the Bush administration. We need to know how this happened so that we can avoid this happening again in the future. And if you want to push for a special investigator, a special counsel to be appointed, I suggest contacting both the White House and the Department of Justice to express your opinion.
All right. Moving on, the Supreme Court looking at a new makeup here in the
here pretty
coming,
soon, yeah.
coming months.
Supreme Court Justice David Souter announced that he was stepping down this week. David Souter is considered one of the liberal four judges on the court, even though he was appointed by George Bush Sr. Quite a while ago. He's not even the oldest of the four so-called liberal justices. He's 69 years old. Justice John Paul Stevens is 89, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 76. The fact that Souter, who was appointed by George Bush Sr., who wasn't considered a liberal when he was appointed, and is considered a liberal now, really points out how far the Supreme Court has swung to the right just in the last 10 years, but it's been actually a longer period than that in which extremely conservative appointees have been appointed and confirmed to the Supreme Court. I think it'll be a little bit easier for Obama to replace him with a person who is liberal or perhaps even more liberal than Souter is, because this week Senator Arlen Specter, senator from Pennsylvania, deserted the Republican Party and declared himself a Democrat. This brings us closer, brings the Senate closer to having the necessary majority on the Senate, 60-vote majority on the Senate that would cut off filibusters and allow Democratic bills to pass and Democratic nominees to pass. Of course, Specter switched parties not because he's a Democrat at heart or because he's suddenly liberal, but also because the Republican Party has moved so far to the right that he no longer feels like he's represented within the ranks of the Republican Party. In addition, he is being challenged in his upcoming race for his Senate seat by a candidate that is very far to the right. He's a very conservative candidate, but he also has very strong backing. And Arlen Specter is worried that he might get knocked out of the Senate race in the primary and doesn't want that to happen, so he switched parties and became a Democrat. So that's a little bit of strategic politicking on his behalf. He adds his name to the ranks of moderate Democrats in the Senate who vote well on some pieces of legislation, and then on others they desert the Democrats and vote with the Republicans. So we'll see. It's sort of a mixed bag with him. But there was also a decision this week that points out why the Supreme Court really matters. In a 5-4 ruling, the Supreme Court upheld an FCC rule that allows the government to fine broadcast media outlets for a single use of certain four-letter words. We've covered this on the show a number of times, but the lawsuit was brought by Fox Broadcasting because they had aired some award shows in which media celebrities had, you know, kind of let four-letter words slip through when they were accepting their awards or announcing their awards. And they were basically saying, look, we have no control over what these people say. It's a live broadcast. We, as broadcasters, we shouldn't be responsible for if they make a slip of the tongue. And we shouldn't be fined, you know, $20,000 or more per each instance by the FCC. In addition, the FCC imposed this rule without going through their standard rulemaking procedures. Well, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 ruling with the conservative justices lining up in the majority, basically ruled on the, yes, the FCC has the right to make this rule and not have to go through their standard rulemaking procedures. They did not rule on the free speech issue. And the conservative justices basically said, well, the FCC can put in place whatever rule they want, especially when it has to do with the welfare of children. Well, the liberal justices on the court then said, excuse me, but, you know, you're worried about a few four-letter words, you know, one or two instances of a four-letter word when you can turn on the TV any evening and see ads for erectile dysfunction. You know, I mean, that's not a problem. So they did have a point. And Fox says that it will go back to the Supreme Court with a lawsuit challenging the free speech issue in the case. But really, the question is, will they need to? Because the Obama administration has the ability well, Obama has to replace three members of the FCC. There are three vacancies on the commission right now. And it's possible that these appointees by the Obama administration, once confirmed, will then withdraw the rule, since it was a Bush administration rule. So we'll see. Have to see what happens in the future. But it's not a, it was not a good thing. And it really points up again how conservative the court has become.
All right. Well, that moves us on then to this week's economic news.
Yeah, lots of news in, on the economy this week. The big news is that the stock markets are rallying, but the economy is not. We're seeing a big bull market and run-up in the, in stocks, probably what they're calling the strongest bull market since 1991. But I have to tell you, it is irrational exuberance, because all the data this week is proving that the economy is still in a downward slump, and it's not coming out of it. The economy shrank by 6.1% in the first quarter. That's the January through March period. Analysts expected about a 4.7 decline, so we're still losing steam, and losing steam faster than anybody has expected. And I should point out, too, that this is almost as bad as the fourth quarter of 2008, when the decline was about 6.3%. So we're not really slowing, and not and, you know, if you want to say 6.1 is you know, we're slowing down, we're not losing steam as fast as we were before, I have to say, no, I'm sorry, the numbers can be revised in the future, and it might be worse than that. So we're not. So things are not getting better, and they're not getting better faster, or they're not getting better at all. And it's interesting too that if you look at it, the only thing that was positive is consumer spending, which went up 2.2%. And consumer spending really reflects not just increased activity in the economy. It reflects that people might be feeling a little bit better and spending a little bit more, or they might be spending more because they need to buy things. They're buying things that they need to, that they held back from buying in the fourth quarter of last year because they figured they couldn't afford it. So consumer spending is a tricky statistic, and pointing out that it increased by 2.2%, which is not a big jump, is not any indication that things are getting better. In all other aspects, things were clearly getting worse. Home building and construction fell by 38%. That's the most since 1980. Business spending was down by its highest rate since the 1950s. Exports fell 30%. That's the worst since 1969. Even government, which you would expect to be spending a lot since the stimulus bill passed, nope, even government across the board trimmed their spending. That's a reflection, I think, of how state and local governments have had to make cuts because of the downturn. There have been declines in credit and financing. Home prices are still going down. We've seen rises in foreclosures and bankruptcies all across the board, and unemployment in all of the metropolitan areas tracked by the Labor Department, unemployment is up. So while all of the indicators show that things are not getting better, and yet the Fed did its job this week of engaging in happy talk. They said that the outlook has improved modestly. The economy is contracting at a somewhat slower pace. You know, on and on, these reassuring words to try to talk people out of the miasma is not doing its job. But the Fed said it would continue. And, of course, then the Fed went on to say it would continue to print more money as fast as it can to help ease credit. So even though the fact that they've been printing money as fast as they can hasn't been helping the problem, they said, well, we will continue to print money as fast as we can because we're still hoping it will help.
I think our friends at the Fed have probably been spending some of their economic stimulus dollars on some of the products that are pharmaceutical products that are advertised during the evening news.
Maybe some pharmaceutical products that aren't legal in this country. Anyway, I want to talk about the Chrysler bankruptcy some, okay, too. It really was inevitable. Chrysler has been in such bad shape that they really can't survive in their current form. They entered Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which would allow them to operate as a company, still operate as a company while they go through the bankruptcy process in court. Basically, they're going to enter court, and a bankruptcy court judge is going to decide which of their debtors get paid and how much. That's basically what Chapter 11 bankruptcy does. Details of the plan are pretty interesting. Chrysler is going to close all of its plants while they're in bankruptcy, but they're going to continue selling their inventory of cars. They have a big inventory left of new automobiles to sell. Their assets, once they emerge from bankruptcy, the plan is that their assets will be given to Fiat, which doesn't have to pay any cash at all for Chrysler's assets. And you might ask, why will Fiat get their assets, their plants in North America, and a 20% ownership stake in the company without paying any cash? And the reason that they will be given that is because Fiat is going to give in return their fuel efficiency technology to Chrysler and going to convert their plants over to making fuel efficient cars and probably trucks as well.
Now, is Fiat a U.S. corporation?
Oh, no, no. Fiat is a European corporation.
Okay.
So Chrysler, if you know anything about the company's history, they sold their European subsidiary a while back, and they haven't had much of a presence in Europe at all. So this was seen as a good move for them. But we'll see. It takes a while to retool plants and get a different kind of a vehicle going. And folks and analysts are saying something like a year and a half before the first fuel-efficient auto runs off the line. We'll see if Chrysler can survive. They currently have $6.9 billion in debt. The current stockholders will be wiped out from this bankruptcy. Current bondholders will only get a fraction, probably about a third of their initial investment back, once the bankruptcy court judge figures out who gets paid what and how much. Once Chrysler emerges from bankruptcy, the United Auto Workers Union Retiree Healthcare Fund will get up about a 55% stake. So they'll be the majority shareholder in Chrysler. And that's a real interesting situation there, to see the United Auto Workers Healthcare Plan get the majority shareholder interest in a major auto manufacturer. That's kind of a first for a United States company. We'll see how that works out. The U.S. government will get an 8% stake in return for about $8 billion in cash and loans that we're just going to give to them. So you might ask, how come the U.S. government isn't the majority shareholder? That's a good question. It's a very good question. Of the $8 billion that they're going to give, that U.S. taxpayers are going to give to Chrysler, about a little less than half of that is going to be cash that will have cash, and the rest is going to be about $5 billion in loans to help Chrysler make it through the period between now and when they start rolling new vehicles off the line. The interesting thing is that they're given up about $7 billion in debt, but they're going to emerge from bankruptcy with about $5 billion in debt owing to the U.S. government. So that begs the question is, you know, are they going to be any better after bankruptcy? Are they going to be able to survive that? And, you know, trading $7 billion in debt for $5 billion in debt doesn't seem like a great deal to me, but, you know, who am I to say? Anyway, another more economic news this week. The credit card holders' bill of rights passed in the House, and it is likely to pass in the Senate as well, and Obama has said that he will sign it. Now, the credit card holders' bill of rights will do some great things. It will restrict increases in interest rates and fees on credit cards. It'll eliminate double cycle billing and retroactive rate hikes. And it will force card companies to apply payments to the highest interest debt first. So folks who have not just made purchases on their credit card, but have also borrowed cash on their credit card and are paying higher interest rates on that cash advance balance, it'll force your credit card holder to apply your payments to the cash advance balance first and pay that down before the lower interest balance, which is not what credit card companies usually do, or not what most of them do. So that's great news, although it's coming a bit late for most people. Even folks with good credit, like me, I have excellent credit, but I got a letter in the mail last week from my credit card company saying, guess what? We're raising your rates. We're raising certain fees on you, even though you have excellent credit and have never had a single late payment. So it's coming very late for just about everybody. The bad news is that even though the credit card holder's bill of rights passed, another bill that was even more essential to helping with the economic crisis didn't pass, a bill that would have given bankruptcy court judges the ability to negotiate mortgage loans during the bankruptcy process, died in the Senate on Thursday. What's really interesting to me about this is that Obama and other leading members of his party pushed really hard in the House to get the credit card bill passed, but they did absolutely nothing to push for the bankruptcy bill. They just let it die. I think history is going to show that that was a mistake, that that was a poor choice, that the credit card bill is a good idea. It's just coming about a year and a half too late, and the bankruptcy bill needs to have been passed about half a year ago at least, and that letting that die was a real mistake. This week as well, Obama announced new guidelines for the Hope for Homeowners program. That's his program that was put in place to help deal with foreclosure problems. And when it was announced, he said this will help up to 500,000 homeowners refinance their loans and help them stay in their homes. Well, so far, only 51 loans have been renegotiated through the Hope for Homeowners plan. That's all, 51 loans. That's a miserable showing. Wow. That is just dismal.
Like one per state.
Yeah, about one per state. You're right. And you might ask, why? How can that happen? A program that was supposed to help 500,000 people only helps 50 people. How can that happen? Well, part of the reason is that a lot of mortgages have been securitized. They've been cut up, diced up, and sold as mortgage-backed securities, so nobody really knows who owns those mortgages. And when you have, say, 50 separate individuals who own your mortgage as part in the form of mortgage-backed securities, you can't contact all those 50 people to renegotiate your loan. That's one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is piggyback loans. Those are second mortgages or lines of credit that were taken in order for people to say, pay off credit card debt or to finance a down payment. A lot of people who didn't put down payments on their homes managed to finance a down payment by taking a second or a piggyback loan. When you have a second mortgage loan, it makes it extremely hard. You can't renegotiate the first loan unless you have the okay of the person or the company or person who owns the second loan. So the new plan now provides incentives for holders of second mortgages to renegotiate the second loan as well as the first loan. But it's very complicated and it's voluntary, and it's not at all clear that it provides enough incentive for second mortgage holders to participate in the program. Of course, the ultimate goal is to eliminate these piggyback loans altogether. That's part of the plan. But here in Washington State, the Washington State Legislature, on the other hand, is getting involved in the piggyback loan business itself. It's part of the, in the closing hours of the state legislative session, the state treasurer, James McIntyre, wrote an amendment to the budget bill that passed that said the $8,000 first-time homebuyer tax credit that you can't get until you file your tax return next year, the state legislature is going to make that available to residents of Washington State when they buy their homes in 2009 in the form of a second loan. So you can take out your first mortgage, and you can take out a second piggyback loan with the state of Washington for $8,000 that you of course will have to pay interest on, and you'll be able to pay it off next year when you get your tax credit from the federal government. The real problem with this is that a lot of people default on their second, or a lot of people will default on their second loans, and then state taxpayers will be on the hook for those defaults, because people who take out piggyback loans are not people who have a lot of cash on hand, have good credit, or have particularly high-paying jobs. So that was a bad move for the state of Washington to get involved in issuing piggyback loans.
All right. Just about out of time. Leaves us no time for talking about this week's swine flu drill.
Yeah, there will be more to talk about on that
but
next week, I'm sure.
The single thing I found interesting about this current situation was that it appears it's been a major boon for Tamiflu, which as of the end of last year was having dramatic sales loss, 68% fewer sales in 2008. That was before CDC and everyone else discovered that it was no longer effective against H1N1. Tamiflu was 99% ineffective. And darn if it isn't the thing, the single thing that they found effective against
the swine flu.
The new swine flu. Uh-huh. So good for them.
Good for them.
All right. Talking with Maria Tomchik, writer with Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
You can find Eat the State around town in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, etc. We're currently doing our fund drive. You can find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you like what you hear on the program here in the mornings, if you like what you read in the paper, if you like what you see on our website, please click the donate button and let us know.